live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. It's the main course on Heritage Radio Network.
It's Sunday.
It must be the main course. I think that is officially a household expression now. If it's Sunday, it's the main course.
It better be.
At Roberta's restaurant.
That's
in Bushwick.
Right. Yes, here we are in beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn.
Well, you look lovely, Katie.
Why, thank you, Patrick. You look really lovely. I know you're traveling later today.
But yes.
So that's a very exciting trip we'll hear about next week, so stay tuned.
Now, today's show was brought to us, but it's a full-fledged sponsor who actually just sponsored this show and also Ann Saxelby's Cutting the Curd. I always wanted her to call that her cheese show Curds Way. But anyway...
Like
the first annual Wisconsin Original Cheese Festival is on November 6th and 7th in 2009 in Madison, Wisconsin. And the annual Wisconsin Original Cheese Festival celebrates the state's growing number of dairy artisans and award-winning collection of American original cheeses. Not American cheese, but American cheese.
Original.
Cheeses. Yeah, American cheese isn't a real specific cheese, is it? Meet 40 cheesemakers and taste more than 100 cheeses. Wow.
And learn more at www.wicheesefest.com. Very much worthwhile because you can...
Do they serve WIC stamps?
No, they don't.
Oh.
Well, I don't know about that. But
WIC Cheese Fest.
Yeah, Wisconsin.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But the thing about going to the website is that then you see all the different cheeses that are going to be at the cheese festival, which means that you can then look for those cheeses at your local markets.
Very inspirational, this whole cheese revolution. I mean, along
Absolutely.
With like bread and beer, you know, America's really, you know, world class now on those three items. And soon now charcuterie is catching up. I mean,
charcuterie is catching up fast. Yeah, absolutely. More and more people getting involved
fish
in that.
And stuff. What's the story? Like, I was just talking with Gwen, who's the gardener here at Roberta's, about what the Norwegians ate. You know, and salted fish was a big component of those
huge.
Four northern countries, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Sure.
So,
cod. In fact, it's a book well worth reading by Mark Kurlansky, the book Cod. Tim's read that, right?
Well, we have an exciting show. I want to mention this, Roberta, we're going to have Timothy Fitzgerald, who you got on. You reeled in. I guess would be.
I reeled him in. I reeled him in all the way from Washington, D.C., where he has just moved. And for whatever reason, he chose to come on up to New York, obviously just to be on the main course with us at Heritage Radio.
Of course,
Network.
That's the only reason. And then Jared Schwartz is going to be on, who I called him. He called me to place an order for Heritage Foods this week. And I was like, oh, you should be on the radio network one day. What's your areas of specialty, you know, of expertise? And he said something I was not expecting him to say, since his restaurant is in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. He said fish.
Okay.
So I'm really interested in landlocked.
Tim, I hope you'll stick around for Jared's portion. Then you can be asking him important and pointed questions about how he sources his fish, make him really uncomfortable.
Well, a little bit of business. Roberta's is doing an event with the Liberty Science Center, and they have some special guests, Joe Bastianich and Mark Ladner of Del Posto. They're also going to have more, you know, impressive people here, you know, like kind of opinion leaders. And it's on October 13th at 7 p.m.
And is it here at Roberta's?
Yeah, here at Roberta's, but it doesn't necessarily say...
But what's the story with the Liberty Science Fest?
$150.
Wow.
It's about an exhibition. They're doing an exhibition about the everyday science experiments that shapes our bodies, our culture, and our planet.
Well, the Liberty Science Center is an absolutely amazing facility.
Is that one when you go to Newark Airport?
Yes.
It kind of looks like a silver dome or something.
It's just on the other side of the river.
So, Katie, we went to Avery Fisher Hall together. Wasn't that lovely?
Patrick, I can't thank you enough for that experience. I mean, that
Dave
was historic.
Brubeck, he's still alive.
This was an historic occasion in which we were privileged to see Dave Brubeck, age 89, with his son Chris, who's probably about my age, and I'd say in his late 40s, early 50s.
I didn't know you were that old.
And two members of Dave's immortal trio, his other two members, his bass player.
Who I really like.
Who was phenomenal. And his drummer, of course, I can't remember the names. But the fact is, I mean, watching these old, you know, forgive me, these old geezers rocking it out.
But with an orchestra
behind
them.
And with an orchestra conducted by the incomparable
João
Carlos Martins.
Right. Very good.
From Brazil. So it was a really extraordinary. I don't have to say Brazil.
No, you can say. You can just say Brazil like a normal person.
Okay, thanks. No, I like to say Hawaii too. You know, I like to get all these. Anyway, it was an incomparable experience. It'll probably be reviewed in the Times today. I'm thinking it will be. But I mean, these people.
Dave Brubeck is real energy. And what I like about it is, you know, whereas American culture rewards youth and the newest face or the youngest, hottest actor, yeah. You know, a lot of other European cultures and art forms, it's actually, you know, the 90-year-old that would do the best job because yeah. It's like a weathered baseball glove or something. You know, it moves perfect. And
he was amazing.
It's efficient.
He was absolutely. And the other thing that was amazing about it, which I found incredibly moving, was the dynamic between the father, the son, his dear friend Joao Carlos, and the fact that they had all and the drummer and the bass player, and they had all known each other for so many years and had been playing together for so many years, and that I found just incredibly affecting emotionally. It was just lovely to see. Beautiful. Anyway,
awesome. Well, we should cut to our guest.
Let's go right to our guest who has made the big trek up here. We have Tim Fitzgerald, who is a marine biologist, marine scientist from the Environmental Defense Fund. And Tim and I met at Teachers College at a forum on fish and sustainable fisheries, I guess. Was that? It was about nutrition. It was for the nutrition school for at Teachers College.
Yeah, it was a panel for public health professionals and trying to navigate the murky waters of sustainability and health issues in seafood.
Right.
From a policy perspective?
Yes.
From all perspectives, policy, just personal health, sustainability.
That was actually one of my questions. I mean, with fish, I know with meats and fruits and vegetables, but as it relates to fish, what would you tell or what did you tell U.S. government policy people, you know, what choices, what changes should be made if Americans are going to start eating healthier?
Well, it was a really interesting event, and I would love to say that everyone on the panel had the same opinion. We had myself, somebody from NOAA Fisheries, which is the government agency responsible for managing U.S. fisheries, and another panelist from Rutgers, and we all had very different things to say. And seafood is, I wish I could say that it was totally straightforward, and it's clear which things are good to eat and which things are bad to eat, and it just depends on your point of view.
Well, what's yours?
Well, you know, my point of view is that fish is probably the healthiest kind of animal protein that you can eat. But there are some kinds of fish that you should eat less often or maybe not at all, depending on who you are. And that's for both health and environmental reasons. And I hope that, you know, we get a chance to talk a little bit more about that today.
Oh, we're definitely
we'll come back to that. But is that like mercury? I mean, those types of issues? Or is it just that some fish are inherently unhealthy to begin with?
Kind of aspects of all of those. We do a lot of research on mercury in fish, PCBs in fish, which are more kind of the risks, but also we look a lot at the benefits. Mm-hmm. Fish is it's a very healthy food, and everyone is talking about omega-3s right now and maybe probably saying they're a little bit better than they actually are, but you know, that's a really great part of eating fish, and it doesn't have to be the debate doesn't have to be as polarized as it is right now. Generally, we want people to eat fish. We just want to be mindful of which ones.
Well, some of the things that were brought up in that panel discussion, which were, you know, certainly news to me and I think probably to many consumers, one was that over 50% of our fish is farmed now. It's not wild. So that was one interesting statistic. And the second related statistic is that 80% of the fish that we consume in the United States is imported. And so those two big numbers were things that made me really think hard about, like, where are we getting our fish? And if 50% of the fish we get is farmed, what can you tell us about the farming practices in other countries besides the United States, or even and also the farming practices, the practice of aquaculture here in the States? Like, what are the differences? What are the challenges? What are the, you know, what are the good and bad aspects of that? Yeah, let's make this really big.
Well, you know, as you pointed out, aquaculture is a huge industry now. It used to be about 10% of our seafood about 25 years ago, and now it's over 50%, and I think a lot of people are probably unaware of that. Most of that aquaculture is happening in other countries. Mm-hmm. Many of them, what we call developing or third world or whatever the term is now. But a lot of our farm fish comes from Southeast Asia and Central America.
So that made me wonder, like, because they're coming from developing countries, which may not have a sort of, you know, like a NOAA-type organization or an environmental defense fund, how can we feel secure about the quality of the fish that is coming in from other countries, which may not have the kind of regulations that we have about how you farm fish?
It's a great point. A lot of those countries don't have the same regulations, or if they do have similar regulations, they may not always be enforced to the level that we might expect here in North America or in Europe. But you know, I would say that the issues that we try and draw attention to with respect to aquaculture are not necessarily country specific. A lot of times they're just inherent to the kind of fish that's being farmed, and so you'll see a lot of information out there about the negative environmental impacts of farmed salmon and farmed shrimp. Those are definitely the two biggest ones that we would call attention to.
Tim, can you explain
why is that? Because demand is higher, because it's an inherently a fish that shouldn't be farmed
or is easily farmed?
Yeah, the demand has actually driven a lot of the negative practices. Farmed salmon, you didn't used to be able to get farmed salmon year round. 15 or 20 years ago, it used to be that salmon was only from wild fisheries, and most of it came from Alaska, and it would be available from May to November. And
frozen the rest of the year. I mean, sustainable people are supposed to eat frozen salmon. I think that goes contradictory to what they would think instinctively about.
Right, and from a quality standpoint, a lot of times salmon that, or fish in general, that's been frozen right after it's been caught is
just as good.
Is actually just as good or even better than something that's been kept fresh for 5 or 6 days.
Right.
Tim, why don't you explain exactly how fish farming works? Because I bet there's a lot of people who don't really know.
Well, as you said before, it covers a huge spectrum, and there are lots of types of aquaculture which are very responsible. Things like farming shellfish, for example, oysters, mussels, scallops, those kinds of things, which are, for the most part, I would say, environmentally benign. They really just kind of
sit
there.
Or even beneficial.
Yeah, because
they're filter feeders.
Yeah.
Exactly. In most cases, they just kind of sit there in the water, either on ropes or rafts or in beds. And you don't have to feed them. In fact, they filter the water and actually improve the water quality. And there's not any additional waste associated with those farming operations. So those are great types of farmed
seafood. And then when you get past that, I mean, when you get past the shellfish, more absorbers, then, I mean, how is there a hierarchy of good to worst?
Once you start talking about fin fish, you know, things that have fins that swim around that we think of as fish, like trout
or salmon.
Salmon, catfish.
That's another highly farmed fish.
Right. The ones that are more herbivorous or less carnivorous, however you want to think about it, the ones that you can put more vegetable components in their feed, those tend to be more sustainable. They don't require as many marine resources. They don't pollute as much. For example, catfish is a very sustainable farmed fish. Rainbow trout is another one. Arctic char, striped bass. These are all things that don't necessarily rely very heavily on wild fish in their feed. They can be grown in smaller systems. They can the systems you can control the pollution and treat it potentially before it gets released to the environment.
What are you talking about when you talk about pollution? Are you talking about just fish matter, fish, fish shit? I mean, one of the questions I had was I saw like a photograph, maybe even at this presentation, where, they were showing the penned fish, and they're in very tight quarters. They're really packed together, and they behave in a lot of ways that, like, say, poultry in those confined area feeding operations, or even cattle. I mean, poultry tend to bite each other a lot, pull out each other's feathers, attack one another.
Do they instinctively crave, or is there instinct, even if they're farm genetics, to go, like, is an instinct of a salmon to go out into the ocean and come back? I mean, is it trying to break out of its area, or have they successfully genetically, are they unhappy? If you could judge happiness,
I think in terms of fish welfare, we probably are 20 years away from knowing how happy or unhappy they are.
I mean, happy meaning being allowed to fulfill their natural instincts and things like that.
Right. I think that especially for salmon, which is the farm fish that we tend to know the most about because it's been farmed the longest, is that they've been selectively bred almost like dogs to exhibit certain traits that, mm-hmm. You know, allow them to grow at higher densities without being antagonistic towards one mm-hmm. another, growing more quickly, turning
feed into
flesh.
So in other words, they've done
flesh.
The same thing with fish genetics that they have done with cattle and with poultry especially.
Absolutely. For the most part, I wouldn't say that it's been... you know, genetic modification or anything like that. It's been more selective breeding just mm-hmm. over a lot of generations. There aren't a whole lot of transgenic salmon or...
Which is just as bad if you consider that they're being done for the wrong reasons and the taste is lost and that it's a food. I mean...
I don't know if the taste is lost or not. I mean...
Isn't it? I've always heard that...
Do you think farmed... I bet most people would not really know the difference between a really fresh piece of farm salmon and a really fresh piece of wild salmon.
I always thought it was the opposite.
Do you think so, Tim?
I've heard both sides of the argument. I've heard that, I know for a fact, for example, that farm salmon is definitely much fattier than wild salmon.
That I've heard.
And so you should be able to tell that, you know, between the wild and the farm salmon. Chefs and restaurants and food service tend to like farm salmon more because it's available year round. It's a consistent quality. It may not be a better quality in the minds of a lot of people, but you know, it is what it is.
In a restaurant setting, you want to have something that's going to taste the same over and over again,
right.
For sure.
It's probably harder to overcook with the extra
with
fat.
All the fat
and, yeah. So, but I've heard scores and scores of chefs say that they can tell, mm-hmm. you know, just from looking at if it's farmed or wild. And,
yeah, I mean, if you have enough experience. Well, I have, sorry, I didn't mean to say that you don't have experience eating salmon, Katie, but...
I actually probably don't because I hate fish.
Really?
Yeah.
You're like me. I mean, I'm bucking the trend of Michael Pollan's don't eat much meat, don't eat that much. I eat a lot of meat.
Well,
so I'm kind of like...
You're a meat dealer, man.
Well, I was reading your website, Timothy, and you were doing some writings about some issues, and I thought I would just bring up a couple of them. So there was one posting, illegal fishing in Costa Rica. What was happened? Was that your writing that you wrote that?
I may have tweeted something about that recently.
So, like, what was that? What was happening there? And let's talk about illegal fishing. And then I have one other one from that list of stuff you wrote about I wanted to ask.
Right. So that kind of gets to the issue of marine protected areas and trying to set aside special places in the ocean so that fish populations can recover and important habitats can be protected, those kinds of things.
Are they usually breeding grounds? Is that the place?
That's one of the most common places to set aside a marine reserve is where a certain population of fish is known to spawn.
Like George's Bank off of Massachusetts, for example, is a really good example for the
right.
Are there areas
for
that
the
are
Northeast.
Concentrated? Like parts of the world that just an inordinate amount of species go because of the weather or temperate climate?
There are these places in the middle of the ocean where lots of fish go and you know, we still haven't figured out why. The place in Costa Rica that has gotten a lot of attention recently is called Cocos Island. It's a lot of times it's talked about in the same discussions as the Galapagos in terms of how much biodiversity there is there, how remote it is, how mm-hmm. beautiful it is. And it's a marine reserve that's protected by the government of Costa Rica. Unfortunately, it's hundreds of miles offshore. Costa Rica doesn't have the resources that it needs to effectively patrol this marine reserve. And so what happens
it,
is
right.
you have a lot of poaching. Mm. And illegal fishing going on, and I believe the thing that I tweeted last week was that National Geographic was actually out there doing a film expedition and caught some illegal fishing on tape, which I'm not sure what they're going to do with. I'm sure that these pirate fishermen probably took off when they saw that they were being filmed, but marine reserves are one way of hopefully helping fish populations rebound and mm-hmm. unfortunately have to be able to monitor and enforce them well.
Well, that brings me to, and I know, Patrick, you wanted to ask about
no
the
rush.
Whole idea of quotas and catch shares and how, because that's a very important part of preserving our fisheries. Is...
Yeah, you were promoting cat shares. What
so
is that?
So let's talk about cat shares and how you do enforce that, because that's, I mean, when you're talking about a fishing community whose livelihood depends upon, you know, bringing in a lot of fish, how do you tell those fishermen, I'm sorry, you can only have 150 pounds a week of cod this week because, you know, whatever. And then a month from now, you can go out and do it again. But, you know, until then, you can figure out another way of making a living, essentially. So that's a real, I mean, the balance between the human component and maintaining the fishing stocks is probably the biggest challenge that we face in terms of environmental protection. And
it's huge. And this is a very important policy issue that's playing out right now, locally, regionally, you know, federally. And if you think about how our fisheries are managed, NOAA, which is the agency that looks after U.S. fisheries, is in the Department of Commerce.
NOAA, for those of you.
Right, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
Well, that doesn't sound very sustainable. It's like a bunch of Republicans in charge of...
of welfare.
Ken Burns just has a new thing on National Parks.
I watched a lot of it yesterday.
There's some Hawaiian volcano that they were trying to save money for back in the day, and the opponent senator leader was like, it should not cost anything to keep a volcano, you know, there. So that is a weird place for that department to be.
Right. So just by where it is in the government, you can see that it's primarily regulated as an economic activity. Not necessarily like a national park or something like that, which is in Department of Interior, and it's more conservation first, economic second.
Do the fishermen get it? Do they just understand that you're not the bearer of bad news, you're a bearer of the truth? Like, they have to slow down if they're going to, or do they fight it and not believe it because, like, the runs seem as big as they remembered from generations past?
Right, there's always going to be some opposition when you tell a fisherman or even a government agency that they're not doing things the right way, and that there's some fault on their part in terms of why things are not as good as they used to be. But I think that there probably aren't very many fishermen out there that would be able to look you in the eye and say with a straight face that things are as good as they were 20 years ago or 40 years ago or even 5 years ago in some cases. So... you know, essentially, the way that most fisheries work is the government sets a total amount of fish that can be caught, and all the fishermen race out to catch all that fish. And the incentive, the main incentive, is just to catch as much as they can before their competitor does.
Uh-huh.
And that's not usually a situation that results in conservation-oriented behavior.
So what is a cat share, then, like, in a sentence?
A cat share is just simply there is still a scientifically determined catch for a fishery. But rather than letting everyone race out to get it, which usually leads to huge overages and excessive fishing gear, unsafe fishing conditions,
well,
market
and also
gluts.
You're picking up species that you don't want. What do they call
those?
There's a name
trawling.
For that.
Bycatch.
Bycatch.
Right.
Yeah.
So
and
when
that
you're
can
racing
be anywhere
the fish,
from seabirds to seals to dolphins to, you know, all those warm
mermaids.
Fuzzy things. Yeah. Right.
Mermaids. Yeah.
Or fish.
Everything.
I want to ask about oarfish later.
I love oarfish. I've never seen one, but hopefully one day I will.
Well, we'll come to that towards the end. But so you were saying that...
Right. So in this race to fish, it's just get as much as you can, mm-hmm. as quickly as you can. Collateral damage is just, you know, a
be
thing
damned.
That happens. And the other part of this is that in these derby fisheries, everyone comes back to the dock with the same product at the same time. Mm-hmm. So you have bad quality... you have market gluts, you have lower prices for fishermen. None of these are good things. So what catch shares does is simply say, we still need a scientifically determined catch. And rather than letting everyone else race and compete to catch it, we're going to tell you at the start of the season what your percentage of that catch is. So you know before you even leave the dock that you're guaranteed a certain amount of fish of that quota. And that removes all of those perverse incentives, excuse me, to overfish, to race,
it's
to
like
be unsafe.
Yeah, totally. Remember the Oklahoma when they opened that up and all the horses were waiting right at the line? And then they went. Remember like when they would open up a state, they would races. I mean, talk about a stressful, unproductive work environment. You wrote about something. Who are the 7 certification programs that matter? Are there 3 or that was one of your postings is there a few that stand out to you as being a seal and a label that consumers can trust?
There aren't a ton of eco-labels for fish right now that consumers are likely going to see in their markets or restaurants, or if they are there, they're probably not going to recognize them. The one, I would say, gold standard right now for labels on fish is something called the MSC, the Marine Stewardship Council, which is based in London, certifies wild fisheries around the world to a standard which, you know, they believe is a sustainable fishery. And it looks at the management of the fishery, the health of the stock, and the, you know, the type of fishing gear they use and that kind of thing.
I get their emails, and it's nice to see they're always adding on new projects and stuff. They're active. They're not, you know, resting on their laurels or wasting government money or nonprofit money doing nothing.
Right. They don't have a huge amount of consumer recognition in the U.S., but that's definitely growing. They've certified a lot of fisheries in the U.S. They're certifying more every day. Alaska salmon is MSC certified. Mm-hmm. Pacific halibut is MSC certified. Some striped bass is MSC certified.
So people could go to the website for this organization and see what fish they should, because that was one of my questions, is how do you know what to buy?
Well, let's come back to that. We have let's go another 10 minutes all the way to 40, but let's do a Heritage Radio drop also to break
absolutely
up the tag cloud. So in honor of fish, we have Moby.
Hi, this is Moby, and you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network.
All right, so
we're back with Tim Fitzgerald,
and we are sponsored today by the Wisconsin Cheese Original Festival, the first annual Wisconsin Original Cheese Festival, November 6th and 7th. Go to WI, which is short for Wisconsin, cheesefest.com.
Thanks, Patrick.
So what were you asking, Katie? Which fish we can eat?
Yeah, can consumers go to the MSC website and see which species of fish are probably better to eat than others? Because now that we have country, one of the things that I have noticed is we have what's called COOL labeling, country of origin labeling, which was fought tooth and nail by the protein industry, and finally came in January, where supermarkets were required to show where their I notice it, especially in the fish counter, where their fish is coming from. So they don't often have the MSC label that I've noticed, but then again, I haven't known to look for it until now. But what besides that website, can we go, like, say, to the Environmental Defense Fund and see what you guys think is the best place to get your fish, whether it's a particular nation or a particular species? That's all out there.
Absolutely.
And MSC label is
definitely. The MSC label is great if you can find it, but I definitely wouldn't guarantee that you can go into any store that you shop in and assume that you can find some fish with the MSC
guidance
label on it, which looks, it's a little blue logo with a white check that kind of looks like a fish. And so, you know, being that you can't rely on the place that you shop to have eco-labeled, traceable, certified, eco-friendly fish available, then, you know, one of the next best options is to use one of these sustainable seafood guides or wallet cards.
Right.
Environmental Defense puts out one. It's edf.org/seafood.
With different colors, right? Shadings from danger zone to green zone.
Right. It's the familiar traffic light color-coded system of red, yellow, green. And you can get it on your BlackBerry, your iPhone. You can get it online.
It's great to have. And everyone I've ever shown them one of those wallet cards when I was carrying them loved it. They were like, "Oh my God, this is all I need." Although it does change.
Right.
In fact,
does change.
Yeah, it changes often.
And that's really important because
it has to.
Fishing practices and farming practices are always evolving, and so we update this at least twice a year to try and reflect that. And if you go to the website or download one of these cards, you can be assured that you're getting the latest information on seafood sustainability.
So I have, can we do a rapid fire? I'm going to name five fish, and you just give me a headline on some aspect of your work, if you know anything.
Okay.
Okay, tuna.
Tuna. Healthy fish. Some kinds are high in mercury. And in general, there are sustainability issues with most kinds of tuna that people eat.
There
so,
is,
like, for instance, bluefin, you should not be eating bluefin. When somebody says they have bluefin tuna on their menu, that's not a good thing.
No, and for those people that are eating lots of bluefin tuna, God bless you in terms of your financial status. But that's probably, I would say, one of the top two or three species in the world in terms of very serious sustainability issues.
What are the top three or four?
I would say bluefin tuna.
This is the danger zone. Should not be eaten.
This is the worst of the worst. Mm-hmm. Bluefin tuna, I would say caviar and sturgeon from the Caspian Sea region.
Especially when we have great American roe here.
Great American sturgeon and paddlefish and trout, mm-hmm. and salmon caviar is readily available and mm-hmm. much more affordable. There are even years when Caspian caviar is illegal.
It's so amazing. People use that as a show of, you know, wealth and power and technically, I guess, intelligence and culture, and yet are being completely ridiculous.
You can
They're
go
going
to
full ridiculous.
Any place that sells caviar is probably going to carry it. And
yeah. Like Petrosian.
That's one of the
Isn't
ones.
Isn't it Petrosian?
That,
so, okay, give us the next three. Caviar, bluefin tuna, and another couple.
Orange roughy is really bad.
Okay, I never see that.
That was a very interesting part of the panel discussion because orange roughy is a fish that lives for 130 years.
What?
And it requires 25 to 30 years before they reach sexual maturity and can reproduce.
Right.
So that's why that fish is so endangered now.
It's a deep water fish. How many?
Are there millions? I mean, is it everywhere?
Not anymore.
They're caught in different parts of the world. They're a deep water fish, and they're one of these fish that came around about 20, 30 years ago as a substitute for other white fish that were starting to disappear, like cod and flounder, for example. And they used to just sell it off as those things. And then once people started to realize that it was a different fish and they actually liked it, then they started to market it under its own new market name. The real name for orange roughy is slimehead. Which,
oh my God, we cannot be
yummy.
That
isn't going to sell very well, and so they gave it a fancy new name, kind of like they did for Chilean sea bass and all kinds of other stuff.
When it's real snaggletooth, right?
Patagonian toothfish.
Toothfish. Yeah. Okay, I got three more. Grouper.
Grouper comes from all over the place. One of the prime candidates for fish fraud in the U.S. A lot of times when you're buying grouper, it's actually something else.
Wow.
So buying from a trusted dealer, fishmonger, restaurant is very important. And most grouper fisheries are overfished because they're another one of these species that lives a long time, takes a long time to 30 reproduce.
30 years, 40 years?
For some of the species, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But the fisheries in the U.S. have made a positive step in the management of their fisheries. They're going to adopt a catch share next year. So
lobster.
Again, from all over the place, the Maine lobster, that kind of iconic species that people on the East Coast are probably most familiar with, is a very well-regulated fishery. I would say the one drawback of lobster is that sometimes they entangle endangered right whales. Not very often, but for an endangered species, even one makes a difference.
Yeah,
so.
Absolutely. Well, I have one and a half more. One's not so serious, but I'm still very interested. So tell us about this 50-foot or fish.
Not wouldn't it be funny if it actually made that noise?
That would be cool.
Be great.
So this is not a fish that I don't know anyone that's eaten it. It's never caught frequently enough to have a market for it, but it's this fish that grows up to 50 feet. A lot of times they were mistaken for sea dragons by...
I said one and a half.
Yeah.
Really?
What was the Loch Ness Monster? What could it have been if it was a fish? So maybe you're answering it.
Yeah, it's a long, slender, almost looks like a giant eel. And then on its head, it's got this rooster looking thing on it with this bright red coloring. And it's amazing. And usually when they're sick or dying, they wash up on shore. And that's how most people see them. But it's a beautiful fish. It's not seen very often. If you do, you're lucky. Go on the website. Go on the web and Google search oarfish, and you'll see how crazy this thing looks.
What waters does it generally inhabit?
All around the world.
Oh, really?
It's an open ocean fish, and again, because it's very long and slender and looks like an eel, you can imagine if you were on a boat in the 1600s or 1700s or something like that, and saw that at the surface of the water. You would probably think
Definitely
it was some
think
kind
it
of
was
sea,
a
monster.
Sea monster.
Giant squid, right? I mean, they're also could have been, I mean, those were, could have been like pulled down small boats or things like that?
Giant squid. I'm sure if I were on a little boat and I saw a 50-foot squid, I would probably be very concerned. But again, not something that most people will see, but and just a very impressive animal that, you know, battles sperm whales. So, I mean, how cool is that?
Speaking of whales, I recently saw an article that the humpback whale is they're considering taking it off of the endangered species list. I'm sure you saw that as well.
Sounds like it's humping a little bit more.
It's been humping, and it has produced. But how realistic is that? I mean, they talked about it being, instead of being 1,500 worldwide, it was maybe, I don't know, 2,500 or something. But it didn't seem like it was that big a jump in numbers to really qualify for being taken off of a potential extinction. Does that seem realistic to you? I mean, I know we don't fish whale anymore, but
well, some countries
some do. Some of them do. Yeah, I mean, the Japanese are still whaling.
There are a few countries that still hunt and kill whale, you know, either openly or
clandestinely,
secretly. Yeah, you know, for anyone that's seen the shows on TV about the Japanese whaling fleet, yeah,
and the people
whale,
that chase
whale wars, yeah. And in some places, humpback whales are very common. If you go to Hawaii or off of Cape Cod and go on a whale watch, I mean, you're almost guaranteed to see dozens of them. But there are other places where they're still not at the numbers that they need to be. And I would, you know, I would be lying if I said that I'm a whale expert and I can tell you where those places are. But in general, marine mammals, especially the big whales, they take a long time to reproduce. A lot of those were really hunted down to almost extinction.
And I mean, look at the land. I mean, what massive animals have survived? I mean, just the elephant. I mean, every animal had a massive version of itself that didn't make it.
That's true. Yeah.
And even in Africa, most of those populations that have recovered have done so because of huge conservation efforts.
Yes. Right.
And for the most part, we don't have those equivalents in the ocean yet.
Well, will you come back? I mean, this has been absolutely fascinating. I mean, obviously, we could have mentioned 700 other fish.
I have so many more questions. I'm bummed.
Well, would you stay with us?
Yeah, stick around, Tim, while we interview this chef. Yeah, because then you can ask him questions about how he manages his,
considering how he's landlocked,
fish consumption. Yeah,
so we can hold him accountable. His food costs just shot way up. Yeah. So let's take a 1 minute break, and we'll come back with Jared Schwartz,
a chef.
Good Jewish chef in Jackson Hole, Wyoming.
Yeah, of all places. Now we're back on Heritage Radio Network. This is The Main Course with Patrick Martins, Katie Kiefer, and our in-studio guest, Tim Fitzgerald from the Environmental Defense Fund.
We want to talk about Roberta's October 13th fundraiser for their garden roof and to build more garden roofs. And we're sponsored by the Wisconsin Cheese Originals, annual Wisconsin Original Cheese Festival. That's what it is. cheesefest.com.
That's right. Check it out so you can see all of the many hundreds of types of American cheese varieties that are being produced now artisanally across the United States.
And thanks to telephone technology, we are on the line with Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Jared, you with us?
I am.
How's it going over there? What's the weather like?
It's raining in town and snowing in the mountains.
Ooh, is it your high season over there or low season?
We're just coming into our low season.
Okay.
So the tourists have all gone home. The dude ranches are closing, and the rodeo is over. Did you go to the rodeo this year?
I couldn't make it. I was usually working.
Oh, that's too bad. I was thinking about driving out myself for the rodeo. It was supposed to be quite
nice. Well, tell us about where you work and how you got to work there.
Well, we started Blue Kitchen about 2 years ago, and we're just, been in Jackson skiing and just became a chef. And
you were in Jackson skiing and you decided to become a chef?
Well, you know, I was a chef.
Was it really that simple?
It kind of was, you know. It was a great job to have and be able to ski all day.
Sure.
So it kind of found me.
Describe the restaurant, like the menu and its ambiance and where it's located in the city.
We're located right downtown, just like a block off this town square, and it's kind of the ambiance is, it's kind of east meets west. It's got all the typical shades you'd find in a cowboy restaurant, but it's very eclectic looking, I guess, contemporary. And the menu, you know, we're a very fish-driven restaurant.
Interesting.
Now, how come you can be a fish-driven restaurant when you're landlocked?
You know, it's the FedEx and UPS do a wonderful job for us.
Uh-huh. And what are the species and, that you use? Cause, you know,
and where
today,
do you source from?
Yeah. Who are you buying it from?
Well, as you guys know, there's tons of purveyors out there. So I deal with people that I've dealt with for years. We have a local guy who started a company called Whole Fish, and he, you know, sources wild, sustainable fish for us. He's a company called Jet Fresh, and they have everything you could imagine. So with that company, it's really up to me to, you know, source the products that I want.
And what type of requirements do you have for that sourcing? Like, do you guys maintain certain standards with what you'll serve at Blue Kitchen?
Yeah, you know, I try to keep it, for the most part, you know, on a sustainable level. You know, we use black cod, wild king salmon, wild rock shrimp. You know, tuna is one of our most popular fish on the menu. I try to use Atlantic yellowfins. I think they grow, mature the quickest as far as tuna go.
Is that right, Tim?
In terms of the larger tuna, like the ahi, the really red tuna steaks that you would buy, that's accurate.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we know that we have somebody from the Environmental Defense Fund here, Jared.
I do.
Have you been listening?
I'm ready to be quizzed.
Yeah, right?
That's good. And so that's a very interesting, is your clientele mostly tourist-based?
We have a great local following. Come wintertime, you know, January till April, and the summertime, which is just ending, we see a lot of tourists. A lot of tourists.
And what are the challenges of, buying fish? I mean, you know, fish goes bad easily or very quickly. You know, it's very hard to keep track of what's sustainable and what's not. Like, from a chef's perspective, like, what is the greatest challenge of maintaining a high-end fish restaurant, you know, on a daily basis?
Well, I think that, I've been in the business long enough, but you really just have to kind of guesstimate how much fish you're going to need for that week. You know, as a chef, I'd rather run out of something than have to throw something away.
Sure.
So, with that said, I try to keep a small amount of fish at any time on the menu. I can't afford to have 8 or 9 different fish.
Uh-huh.
You know, especially come off season. So we have just a core fish that we keep on the menu.
And do you peruse sites like the Environmental Defense Fund or the MSC labeling that Tim was talking about earlier, so that you know you can stay abreast of like the changing quotas in fish stocks and all of that kind of stuff, or is that just like too much? That's hard to do if you're running a restaurant. So
no, absolutely. I think that's part of your responsibility. You know, if I'm feeding people, I want to make sure that they're, you know, coming to the restaurant and getting something healthy, you know, whether it's the pork I'm getting from Patrick or beef or, you know, the fish that I'm getting. Like we never carry bluefin tuna, you know, something we just don't get. Caviar, you know, we go with U.S., you know, farmed or paddlefish, things like that. You know, we just try to be very conscious about what we're buying.
So, hi, this is Tim Fitzgerald. I just wanted to chime in with a question that I often, hear is a challenge for chefs, and that is, you know, especially if you guys are known as the seafood game in town, and you have loyal customers, how do you handle that potentially awkward situation when somebody comes in and really, you know, wants you to serve something that you know is maybe not sustainable, but it's, you know, that customer demand is going to be there, like Chilean sea bass or, you know, something like that.
Well, it just, you know, I guess it's, we try to educate that person. The bottom line is basically it's my call. You know, I'm not going to serve something to one person. It's because they're demanding it. You know, it's really, you know, I think it's really about educating the consumer, you know, what they should or shouldn't eat and why. And but if someone's coming in asking that,
does the distributor ever be like, Jared, you got to take this, you know, I got 600 pounds I got to move, you know, and you're like, oh, I've never really heard of that fish.
Sell it to you for $5 a pound. No. You know, my consumer, my distributors are pretty good. Are pretty good. And, you know, so I they never try to push something on me. You know, and I'm aware that, you know, some of these bigger distributors are, you know, anything under the sun you can get, basically.
And Tim,
but I think as a chef, you really gotta, you know, decide what you want to put on your menu.
Now, Tim, do you guys work with distributors? I mean, is that a component of what the Environmental Defense Fund has to do? Is try to get some type of decency out of that segment of the line?
We have done partnerships with corporations on seafood before. We've tended to focus on food service companies and retailers. Mm-hmm. That's been the part of the supply chain that we've had expertise in. For example, we did a project with Wegmans, which is a, you know, kind of a boutique grocery chain in the Northeast, on improving the farm salmon that they were selling. So we actually worked with their farm to have better practices. And Wegmans was able to, you know, have a campaign with that and sell it at a marginal price increase over the regular farm salmon. So that was really good. But there are lots of environmental groups that are doing projects like that with companies at different parts of the supply chain. So there are some that specialize in working with restaurants, others that specialize in working with wholesalers or distributors. So, you know, if you're a company that wants to try and be more sustainable with your fish, I can guarantee you there is one or multiple environmental groups that are willing to work with you to help you do that.
Well, I have a question I'd like to ask both of you. Maybe you each give like a 2-minute answer. Timothy, maybe we'll start with you. Practical and realistic action that you would recommend to, you know, basically improve the situation of our seas and its fish. I mean, not expensive either. Not like, well, with $10 billion, like, you know, understanding the current economic situation, and there's not many dollars available for things other than, you know, almost survival. You know, what is a realistic action that you would recommend to improve?
If you're an individual consumer, there's a couple of very simple things you can do. One is just recognize that different fish has different environmental impacts, and starting to ask questions of the people you buy fish from, hugely important. That sends a signal, you know, through the industry that says sustainable seafood is important to you as a consumer, and businesses don't succeed by ignoring their customers, basically. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you're not sure about what to buy, that's what these little cheat sheets are there for, the seafood selector, the pocket guides, the iPhone apps, all those things. In terms of fisheries management and aquaculture and what governments can do, ending a lot of these subsidies for overfishing and fixing these ridiculous rules that basically pit fishermen against each other, I think is one of the most important things. So,
Jared, what would you say? I mean, from your neck of the woods and from what you see in the middle of the country.
I think that, you know, as a chef, you know, you really have to educate your consumers, you know, and have the public just educated. And once you're educated, they can ask their own questions and make sure what they're consuming is a sustainable product or something that's healthy. I think it's about education, you know, and there's tons of information out there on websites, like Tim said, the Pocket Guide. I think it's really important that people get on that bandwagon, and I think once they're educated, they'd be willing to spend an extra dollar or $1.50 for a wild salmon as opposed to a farmed Atlantic salmon, or realize they shouldn't be eating this bluefin tuna, even though it tastes so good and so great with sushi or whatever, but they shouldn't be eating that, you know, and try some of these other sustainable fish that they maybe haven't heard of before.
You know? Brought up a point just now where, you know, it was maybe better to eat wild, pay an extra dollar and eat wild fish as opposed to a farmed fish. But as we were discussing earlier in the program, aquaculture is a really big economic force now. So
right.
In a way, and also it's a great way to feed our giant and ever growing population. So I think aquaculture is here to stay, and it has to have its place, in the food chain. So, you know, it's an interesting conundrum because on the one hand, you want to support the people who are doing aquaculture because in a way it's a very responsible practice in terms of feeding our populations. But at the same time, it comes with its share of pitfalls, as we discussed earlier. So I guess the question is like, how can you encourage consumers, you know, as a chef, to support the good part of aquaculture and be aware of the good practices and like find the people who are doing it well, as opposed to buying indiscriminately. And I think that's where educating the consumer becomes really kind of tricky and complicated.
Yeah,
and one of the rules of thumb that we try and give people is, regardless of whether it's wild or farmed, this goes to the Michael Pollan point that you made earlier. The lower on the food chain you can eat in terms of fish, the better, because
right, which are like some of those darker fish, right, like anchovies,
sardines, herring, mackerel, those kinds of things.
They're the most delicious.
They're often the healthiest, and they're
they have a lot of omega-3s,
and they're
that.
Often the
oily.
Least expensive, and so sustainable fish doesn't have to be more expensive.
Right, and those are some of the fish as a chef that, you know, you want to put on your menu and you want people to experience.
Why is that?
And they can be tough sells because they're not as common on a menu, but it's something that as a chef that's what you want to use. You want to use something different, something
challenging.
You know, you don't want to use tuna or salmon or yellowtail, something that's everywhere. You want something that is a challenge for you, and that you can. Someone might think mackerel, oh, it's so fishy, but when they have it, they're like, wow, this is great.
It's kind of like the whole movement of chefs to use pork bellies and trotters. And,
that's right. The nose to tail kind of eating. I mean, you know, we have to be aware that there's more than one. There's more than five species out there, regardless of what you see in your local fish markets or what's on the restaurant menu.
And there's more than five grains out there, and there's more than five turkey companies,
yeah,
and
exactly.
There's more than, you know.
It looks like we have to wrap it up. I see.
This has been great, Jared. Thank you for waking up so early.
Yep,
I know that's not easy for chefs.
Welcome.
Are you skiing right now?
No, we won't.
Is that the swooshing I hear?
We can practically hear you shushing through the veils there.
Well,
I wish I was skiing right now.
Timothy, thank you for being on. What a great show, and to hear from Chef's perspective. But you know what you're doing is absolutely unbelievable, and really
we hope you'll come
back.
I would love to come back. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, that would be great. All right, this has been The Main Course on the Heritage Radio Network.
We were produced by
Nat Wiener, by Heather Hyman, and engineered by Nat Wiener. Thank you very much. And
we'll
sponsored
be back next
by
week.
The Wisconsin.
Oh, I'll be back next week.
That's right. I won't be back next week. We were sponsored this week by the first annual Wisconsin Original Cheese Festival. Take a look at www.wicheesefest.com to learn more about American cheesemakers. Bye, everybody.
Hey, Patrick.